This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 17th of July, 2015. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 17th of July, which this week have been edited by Margaret Boyden and Linda Vincent. Your readers today are Nikki Baring.
Hello.
John Regan.
Hello.
And Daphne Poupart.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Keith Vincent. And the main headlines this week: Silver Hill liftoff, King's Royal Hussars stage freedom parade in city, and EDF withdraw wind farm plan. So may we have the story behind the first headline, please, Nikki?
Which is Silver Hill liftoff. Winchester civic chiefs were last night poised to remove the last barrier to the Silver Hill scheme amid the growing prospect of legal action from opponents. The development moved closer to approval this week, despite concerns over the public's ability to scrutinise confidential documents. Cabinet agreed on Monday that developer TH Real Estate had, subject to a handful of clarifications, met its obligations under the £150 million deal for shops, homes and a new bus station, paving the way for construction this winter. But rebel city councillor Kim Gottlieb has threatened new legal challenges to block the regeneration, which he warns will wreck the city centre. TH Real Estate's submissions on financial viability, housing and funding partner were set to be discussed at the marathon meeting of full council last night, informing a final decision from Cabinet immediately afterwards. Councillor Lucille Thompson, Liberal Democrat leader, criticised the secrecy over complex financial data that backed the developer's contentious claim that the project is again financially viable. At least 10 reports have been withheld from the public under commercial and legal confidentiality. Disclosing details of unsigned contracts could threaten deals, council officers said, while publicising data like land values could affect viability. The Chronicle understands that TH Real Estate's estimated profit margin, which must be 10% or over for the scheme to be viable, is now around 12%, up from 10.32% in August 2013. TH Real Estate has been criticised by campaigns for claiming the scheme became unviable between these dates. The council's consultants, Deloitte and Knight Frank, said the developers' numbers were robust and met industry standards. And a second column: whatever decisions are taken over Silver Hill, Winchester City Council can be sure the threat of legal action is not far away. Anti-Silver Hill campaigner Councillor Kim Gottlieb has threatened to launch as many as 5 challenges if councillors approve the scheme on Wednesday night. They include an injunction blocking the council's approval of TH Real Estate's financial viability claims and an application to quash the council's attempts to use the compulsory purchase order. Councillor Gottlieb is also bidding to save the partly medieval Cross Keys passage from redevelopment by forming a trust to buy it from the City Council. Officers are looking to redevelop 153 High Street, currently an Oxfam shop, as part of plans to draw footfall down the High Street. The Cabinet rejected Councillor Gottlieb's offer of £750,000 for the shop on Monday, arguing it would be worth more in the future as Silver Hill pushes up rents. The threat of litigation from TH Real Estate re-emerged in Guildhall discussions this week. The 2004 development agreement obliges the council to act reasonably if it is to terminate the deal. Council lawyers from Berwyn, Leighton, Paisner told the Overview and Scrutiny Committee on Monday that litigation could drag on for years and affect the way other developers look at the scheme. The council is taking legal advice on whether TH Real Estate met a key construction deadline, which, if missed, would give councillors grounds to terminate the deal. And lastly, from Judge Derwin Hope: scheme a disaster, says judge. A retired judge with 50 years of experience in planning and property law has branded the Silver Hill scheme a disaster and urged the government to intervene. Derwin Hope, formerly senior resident judge at Southampton Crown Court, alleges that the City Council has lacked transparency and respect for the law over the regeneration. Mr. Hope has lived in Winchester for more than 30 years, but says he was unfamiliar with details of the scheme until he was spurred to study it by a Chronicle editorial. The 70-year-old of Christchurch Gardens claims to have read planning briefs and legal documents from morning till night for a week to get to grips with the project. In an appraisal shared with all 57 city councillors, Mr. Hope claims the authority breached its own planning rules by allowing the development to reach six stories. A council spokesman said the 2003 brief was advisory rather than binding. Greg Clark, the local government secretary, is considering whether to call in the 2014 proposal.
Now here's a big, bright and colourful splash on the front page, headed King's Royal Hussars stage Freedom Parade in City Centre. They marched through Hampshire's ancient military capital to mark 300 years of service. Around 250 troops from the King's Royal Hussars paraded the streets of Winchester last Thursday in a flash of blades and bayonets. Hundreds followed the band of the Royal Armoured Corps down the High Street as the soldiers paced in their distinctive crimson trousers. Winchester boasts hundreds of years of military history and remains a recruitment base for the Hussars. Many of its troops, in fact, were trained at the nearby Sir John Moore Barracks. The parade marked the tercentenary of the cavalry regiment's formation in 1715, defending the crown from the Jacobite uprising. Onlookers swapped Union Jacks for camera phones to capture the parade, which started at the city's Peninsula Barracks. The Hussars, now based in Tidworth, have served in conflicts from the Peninsula and Crimean Wars to the Second World War, and more recently, it has completed tours of Iraq, Kosovo and Northern Ireland, earning the Freedom of Winchester in 2005. The regiment last marched through the city in 2012 after a tour of Afghanistan. Thursday's parade ended at Winchester Guildhall, where soldiers were received by dignitaries including Lord Lieutenant Nigel Atkinson and Angela Clear, the Mayor of Winchester. Addressing the troops from the Guildhall steps, Councillor Clear said, "This city is proud to trace its links with the armed forces back to the Roman period. It later became the central city of Wessex, where Alfred the Great created our first national forces, and then the capital of England, where it became a key army base. To the soldiers present here today, I would say that most of us can only imagine the daily dangers you face during your tours of duty. However, it's important for you all to know that you've earned the utmost respect for the brave and professional way you carry out your work."
EDF withdraw wind farm plan. Thank God they have seen sense and done the honourable thing. Those were the words of a Green campaigner after plans to appeal a controversial wind farm in Hampshire were withdrawn. EDF Energy Renewables confirmed it will drop plans to build near Bullington Cross, which, as previously reported, was rejected by three separate planning committees at a meeting last year. Civic chiefs from Winchester, Test Valley and Basingstoke councils turned down the application last June at a meeting at Winchester Guildhall, which would have seen the development of 14-turbine, 28-megawatt wind farm on farmland to the north of the A303. EDF announced its intention to appeal last December, but changed its mind in the days leading to the appeal submission date. Chairman of Keep Hampshire Green, Douglas Patterson, said he was overcome with joy at the news. "We were absolutely delighted," he said. "After 3 years of worry, it is hard to describe how happy and relieved we are that this ordeal is finally over. It always was the wrong place to build a wind farm, and our planners, parish councillors and district councillors made that clear last summer when permission was refused. There are places where wind farms are appropriate, but this is definitely not one of them. In terms of wind resource, it would have been in the worst 5% of wind farm sites in the UK. To scar this beautiful stretch of unspoilt countryside for such poor return would have been scandalous. It is only the distorted subsidy system that drew EDF to this site and made them determined to appeal the local democratic decision. Finally, EDF has recognised that there is no point in pursuing this project any further. Thank God they have seen sense and done the honourable thing. Many people care deeply about the countryside, and for those whose communities would have been blighted, this would have been devastating. The plans to build the 126-metre-tall masts were met with fierce opposition from local councillors, as well as defence chiefs, who argued it could disrupt radar systems. As previously reported, radar operators find it hard to distinguish between low-flying aircraft and wind turbines, causing confusion for civil and military air traffic controllers. An impact statement submitted as part of the planning application to Winchester City Council cited Bullingdon Cross as an extremely busy aviation site with a high density of both military and civil aviation activity. EDF were contacted but declined to comment further.
Thank you. That concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the death announcements, followed by Christian comment, letters, historical, chronicle comment, and first person and Belgarum. So we start with the death notices for this week. Baker, Sandra May Baker, formerly of Southwestern Inn, died on the 3rd of May in Ripon. Carpenter, Frank Carpenter, died peacefully at home, aged 94. Edwards, David George Edwards, died peacefully on the 12th of July, aged 82. Everett, Brian Alfred Everett, died on the 7th of July, aged 87. Gallienne, John Morris Gallienne, died peacefully at home, aged 72. Gibbons, Beau Gibbons, nay Bradley, died suddenly and unexpectedly, aged 64. Hardy, Derek William Hardy, formerly of South Wanston, passed away in a nursing home in Anglesey, aged 94. Kenway, Edward Kenway, died peacefully on the 10th of July. Latter, Ruth Mary Latter, nay Arnold, died suddenly and unexpectedly on the 30th of June. And Southon, Stella Sarah Southon, nay Naylor, died on the 26th of June, aged 92. And now we move on to Christian comment, Daphne.
Why go on holiday? And this comes from Mary Gray. Next week, the school holiday season will again be upon us. Whether we take off alone or with family to sea, hill, dale, or simply stay at home, the question stares us in the face. What is the point of holidays from a Christian or indeed any religious standpoint? If we look at the scriptures, it is striking that Jesus never took a holiday. His mission was too urgent. But he did set off on journeys. Indeed, for 3 years he was always on the road, and chose to stop on mountainsides for picnics and teachings, as well as on the lakeside of the Sea of Galilee. It was on journeys that significant events took place, as in the Hebrew scriptures, where Tobias was accompanied by the archangel Raphael, and in the inn at Emmaus, where the risen Jesus revealed himself to the two disciples. The motif of rest is at the heart of the meaning of holidays. To rest, either in solitude or with those dearest to us, from work that is exhausting or meaningless to us, or simply does not give us enough to live on. God too rested on the seventh day of creation. It follows that holiday means rest with time to reflect, the second R, on life and relationships. Some of the most dramatic conversion stories in Christian tradition followed times of reflection. Sometimes reflection goes hand in hand with recreation, the third R. Maybe this does not sound scriptural or religious enough, but Christianity has always gone hand in hand with feasting and rejoicing. Not for nothing do Christians sing the hymn, "The Lord of the Dance." There is a story told by Anatole France of a simple French monk who juggled before God. Head downward, feet in the air, he juggled with 6 copper balls and 12 knives. Clowning before God, playing before God, is a very ancient theme, but not without purpose. The goal of all this is change, transformation. Pope Francis' encyclical, Laudato Si, makes this clear. Wonder and praise of creation is at its heart, so that we are changed. As the novelist Annie Dillard in her novel Pilgrim at Tinker Creek cried, "This is the way the world is, altar and cup. We have to live intensely and we will be transformed utterly. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. That's the catch. If you can catch it, it will catch you up, aloft, up to any gap at all, and you'll come back. You will come back, transformed in a way you may not bargain for. Rest, reflection, recreation, transformation. Good reasons enough to go on holiday." And that comes from Mary Gray.
Thank you. Now we move to letters. And Nikki, you've got the first one, please.
And it's from David Selby. Safer cycling. Sir, in no way do I condone unthinking cyclists who break the law by cycling on pavements or jumping red lights. Chronicle Letters, July the 9th. But there are times in the lives of most cyclists when unthinking or careless motorists endanger their lives and they feel that cycling on the pavement is the better option. Car owning is king in Britain, as in America. British governments, both local and national, pay lip service to cycling, feeling that a metre-wide strip down the side of a busy road solves the problem. In the London Borough of Richmond and elsewhere, the metre-wide strips are treated as car parks, not as a priority for cyclists. On the new A43 dual carriageway past Silverstone, a 5-figure sum must have been spent on white lining and signage. I've never seen a cyclist use the metre-wide strip on the many times I use that road. Would you use it with vehicles passing at 70-plus miles an hour? If we are to promote cycling for healthy exercise, going to work, to shops, or just as leisure activity, then we have to think more carefully about safe cycling facilities separate from motor vehicles. The Barton Farm development has a proposal for a separate cycle path into Winchester. There is money available from the Worthy Down development that could provide a safe off-road cycle route for the young recruits to Sir John Moore Barracks, backed by recent leader of Winchester City Council. South Wanston Parish Council has also backed our proposal for a feasible off-road safe cycle route to join up with the two above to enable young people to cycle to their local school and college, for instance. Will Hampshire County Council, the overall transport authority, pull all these proposals together to provide a safe off-road cycle path into Winchester for the benefit of both cyclists and drivers, or will the interests of the latter continue to prevail? David Selby of the South Wanston Safe Cycling Campaign Group, West Hill Road North, South Wanston.
And here's a contribution to the ongoing Barton Farm controversy by Martin Biddle, who's director of the Winchester Research Unit. It's headed Grasp the Challenge. Sir, Andrew Napier's excellent article emphasises the importance of the archaeology of Barton Farm. The prehistoric and Roman discoveries there are important, but the remains of the two 18th century military camps are in another class. By 1756, Britain had a treaty with the state of Hesse in Germany, under which Hesse kept a standing army ready to help us when need arose. With the outbreak of the Seven Years' War of 1754-63, Britain invoked the treaty, and the Hessians arrived and camped at Barton Farm from October 1756 for several months. The Hampshire Record Office has 2 engravings showing the vast camp as it stretched downhill over what's now Barton Farm, from Andover Road into the valley and up to Worthy Road. The recent exemplary excavation by pre-construct archaeology of a small part of the camp confirms the accuracy of these engravings, but it adds information of a kind never otherwise known, in particular, what happened as the winter closed in. No major army camp of this date, British or foreign, has ever, to my knowledge, been archaeologically investigated on the continent, in England, or even in America, to which the Hessian army was soon to move to support the British. And on top of all this, there's a second camp of 1761, a little north, for six English militias, including the South Hampshires. Here, Edward Gibbon, author of The History and Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, gained his only experience of military life as a captain in the Hampshires. So we have an outline plan of Gibbon's camp, but nothing else is known. A tiny part of this camp has also been recently excavated, but otherwise it remains completely unknown. The Historic Town Atlas of Winchester, to be published next year by the Winchester Excavations Committee as the 11th volume in the Winchester Studies, has, for the first time, mapped the city as a major military centre from the 18th to the 20th centuries. It demonstrates that the archaeology of the military camps at Barton Farm is certainly of national importance. The archaeology of the Hessian camps is also of international importance. This does not seem to have been taken on board. No other examples of sites of this kind are known to survive in such an untouched condition as in Barton Farm. Large-scale excavation of most camps must be undertaken under professional archaeological control before any development takes place. An archaeological watching brief conducted by the developer, such as has been proposed by one interested party, is not the answer. This is a major challenge for Winchester, and it must be grasped.
And this letter comes from Judith Martin. Sir, on a lamppost in Andover Road is a restrained handwritten poster. Barton Farm, 2,000 houses, 4,000 cars. Of course, the protester can be reassured, because, as we were solemnly told at the public inquiry, the development will eat its own smoke. The consultant who explained that was saying that the development would have no impact on traffic at the city road lights. I've wondered since if developers compete to devise outrageous new pronouncements just to see what a gullible council will swallow. The proposed new route through the police headquarters that architect Kate McIntosh is rightly criticising, a route which already exists, is another such. It's not clear whether it's gullibility or just car worship that means every new development makes for worse noise, pollution and visual blight. Winchester's approach to traffic is, in European terms, stuck in the Dark Ages. Good policies about peripheral parking, i.e. park and walk from Chesil Street or the Cattle Market, about reduced central parking as park and ride came on stream, or about introducing Sunday charges like Chichester and most other places, have either been overturned or were just never implemented. Meanwhile, the council adopts cycling and pedestrian strategies that have little hope of success in the face of the car onslaught. And that comes from Judith Martin, Romsey Road, Winchester.
And from Frank Pearson. Civic tribute to children at Hat Fair. Sir, one of the first events of the Hat Fair was a parade of children from primary schools in Winchester who must have spent many hours devising and making a glorious array of headdresses and models. As the children gathered in Abbey Gardens, there was the excitable chatter of anticipation. Yet as the clock struck 12, as if at the flick of a switch, over 450 children stood still and silent, not a movement or a murmur as we joined in a minute of respect for those killed or injured in Tunisia. The hush was palpable. Some of the children would not have understood the significance of what was happening, but they had been prepared beforehand and did as they had been asked. It was my privilege to share in that moment, an emotional moment witnessed by all those gathered there. Children, thank you for being the pride of Winchester. And that from Frank Pearson, Portfolio for Environment, Health and Wellbeing, Winchester City Council. And there's a lovely photograph of about 10 of the children, obviously having a big cheer with their arms in the air and enjoying their day.
Air pollution. Sir, In April 2015, the UK Supreme Court ruled that any incoming government must make tackling air pollution one of its priorities. The UK has consistently breached EU pollution limits, even though air pollution causes more than 29,000 premature deaths a year and is linked with heart and respiratory diseases. The UK has failed in its legal duty to protect people from the harmful effects of air pollution, and the consequent illnesses represent a huge burden to an already overstretched NHS. Winchester City Council is guilty of a breach of EU pollution regulations and is under threat of being fined by the EU. Meanwhile, however, it's wanting to move forward with ambitious development projects, some of which involve building on those surface peripheral car parks which reduce traffic driving into the city centre. The City Council is at present considering borrowing in excess of £19 million to help finance the development of the Carfax and Cattle Market sites alone. So, should it consider borrowing a few million more in order to pay the threatened EU fine? Any new construction is inevitably going to result in a dramatic increase in pollution. And of course, this will be exacerbated in the near future when Barton Farm is up and running. If the council is borrowing such a large amount of money, should we not be told from whom? And have they taken into account the cost to the people of Winchester, not only financially, but also in terms of health and quality of life? And that impassioned letter comes from Caroline Dennis of Worthy Lane in Winchester.
And this letter from Penny Lydon. Sir, the recent planning application from Barclay Homes to build on the Hampshire Constabulary headquarters raises a number of concerns. I am not sure Winchester residents realise the scale of the proposed development. My first concern is the impact on neighbouring properties. The plans show a mix of 208 apartments and houses, 50 of which are designated affordable housing. Total number of bedrooms is 440. There is provision for 259 parking spaces with 20 visitor parking spaces. The greatest density of people will live in two large apartment buildings on the plans, marked D1 and D2. These are located in the southeast corner of the property and are up to five stories high on elevated land adjacent to West End Terrace. The police headquarters is nine stories high. I am very concerned the two proposed buildings will tower over the area, be seen far and wide, and in fact impact more than the police headquarters due to their placement on the lot. Second concern is design of these two apartment buildings and how they fit into the City Council's design guidance. They don't relate in any way to the unique architectural heritage of the area, with many Grade 2 listed homes, usually 2 to 3 stories tall. The design looks as though the main concern was to accommodate as many people as possible in a small space. Finally, the lack of parking for the residents. The area now serves its existing residents with a mixture of on- and off-street parking. Adding more cars will tip this balance. I hope the planners will not be swayed by government quotas for the increase of city dwellers and really take the time to look at this development. Please protect the people of the surrounding area and challenge the developers to create something more suitable for the lovely area surrounding Orams Arbour and the Romsey Road. And that comes from Penny Lydon, Clifton Hill, Winchester.
Thank you. That concludes the letters. Now we're going to move back in time with some historical items starting 100 years ago. Nikki.
July 17, 1915. Farewell to troops. After a busy month with the military, Winchester is again enjoying a state of normality and embracing an opportunity to take stock of itself. The departure of troops this week have presented animated scenes in the neighbourhood of the London and South Western Railway Station. A very large number of the wives of the men who have been encamped at Winchester came down since the weekend, and on several occasions the police have assisted them to find lodging accommodation. The second item, successful air raid. The most interesting piece of news from the Western Front is a successful raid by 35 French aeroplanes on the German strategic railway that serves the famous Calonne Trench and the forest of Apremont. They dropped 171 3.5-inch shells on the military shores of Vigneux-les-Hattonchâtel and caused outbreaks of fire. The aeroplanes returned safely.
And two pieces from 50 years ago, July 17, 1965. Firstly, refinery expansion. The Esso Petroleum Company is to increase the capacity of its refinery at Fawley from 111 to 161 million tonnes a year. The Fawley refinery is already the largest refinery in the United Kingdom, and this expansion will put it amongst the six largest in the world in terms of retaining capacity, of which three others are also Esso refineries. This expansion has become necessary to meet the steady increase in the consumption of petroleum products and will cost approximately £7 million, more than 90% of which will be spent with British firms. And the second piece is headed Grammar Objection. A proposal of Hampshire County Council to establish a new grammar school at Romsey to serve an area which also includes Chandler's Ford was opposed at a meeting of the Eastleigh Borough Council General Purposes Committee on Tuesday.
And now 25 years ago, July the 13th, 1990. Circles baffle experts. Flying saucers, wind patterns, or man-made hoaxes? Scientists are more baffled than ever over the mysterious circles continuously appearing in fields around the Winchester area. Alsford investigator Mr. Pat Delgado has studied the circles for over 10 years and, with the help of local crop watchers, discovered several more peculiar patterns last week. One, located west of Moorstead, has markings that might be regarded as the shape of a flying saucer. It has a huge centre circle and four uniform smaller rings evenly spaced around it, which are approximately 20 feet in diameter. Mr. Delgado described this particular circle as unusual because crushed wheat in the larger ring faces a clockwise direction, while the four smaller ones run anti-clockwise. And the second item is fighting to save down. Following the ruling by the Department of Transport on the route for the M3 Missing Link south of Winchester, a new association has been formed to protect Twyford Down for the enjoyment and education of future generations. The Twyford Down Association, founded by Barbara Bryant, David Croker and Merrick Denton Thompson, aims to extend the boundaries of the St Catherine's Hill Nature Reserve to include Twyford Down to afford it additional protection. The primary objective, however, is to challenge the Department of Transport's decision in the High Court, as otherwise there will be nothing to protect.
Thank you. Back to the present, and we have editorial comment followed by First Person and Belgarum. Nikki.
Editorial comment. Many wrong reasons for future memories. The City Council last night almost certainly decided to press ahead with the Silver Hill development alongside developer TH Real Estate, with many misgivings, not least over TH's flip-flopping over viability. It is, on balance, the right thing to do. Kim Gottlieb is preparing further legal action, so the future is uncertain. One thing is clear: the damage to the reputation of the council. Many people believe it handled Silver Hill very badly. Its recent decisions stem directly from one made in 2004 to sign an exclusivity agreement with TH's predecessor, thereby cementing the whole scheme in damaging secrecy. As well as the chronic congestion during construction, it is this damage that will be remembered for years.
Now, here's a somewhat controversial first-person piece by George Hayter this week, and it's headed, Why We Must Destroy This Village. He says, I fell in love with a vanished village while writing a book about Heathrow Airport. Nearly 30 years ago, I embarked on research for the Pan paperback called Heathrow, The Story of the World's Greatest Airport, because I was interested in aviation. But As I investigated the airport's World War II origins, my interest shifted to the village of Heathrow, which had once stood where today there are only huge runways. The villagers were betrayed by the Air Ministry, which used wartime powers to evict them. Then their homes were demolished to make way for the runways. Officials at the time pretended that a giant new airfield was needed to supply British forces fighting the Japanese, but their real intention was to build a huge civil airport. And the more I found out about the village and talked to people who'd known it, the more I was enchanted. Heathrow had been a 1930s backwater, one of the most rural spots within an easy drive of London. Local children could set up stumps in its main road and rarely have their cricket disturbed by more than a passing bicycle. Heathrow's fertile soil was classified Grade 1, and the area's abundant market gardens and orchards were punctuated by flooded gravel pits. These old workings had matured into reed-fringed lakes rich in wildlife. The biggest house, near where Terminal 2 stands today, was elegant Heathrow Hall, set in mature trees. There were thatched cottages. The nearest thing to a church was a Methodist chapel of corrugated iron where the harmonium was played by a Miss Harbour. Where Terminal 3 now stands was the village pub, the Plough and Harrow. Before its residents were finally expelled in 1944, Heathrow Village had been there a long time. It was shown on maps as Heatherhoo in the 15th century, and my own late 18th century map of 20 miles around London labels it Hitherow. That same map shows the nearby village of Harmondsworth, which, unlike Heathrow, avoided obliteration by airport construction. Harmondsworth is still there today, complete with its village green, but maybe not for much longer. This month, an independent report recommended construction of a third Heathrow runway, and if it goes ahead, most, if not all, of Harmondsworth will be demolished. The case for a new runway is compelling. Because of airport congestion, there's no room for airlines to introduce new routes, including ones to emerging economies. When growing companies in, for example, a provincial city in China, find they're unable to reach London without changing planes in one of our competitor countries, such as France or Germany, they may just be more likely to do business with them than with us. The runway crisis means British firms are literally disconnected from new markets. The Airports Commission report recommends that the much-needed new runway should be at Heathrow, rather than either at Gatwick or on Boris Johnson's dream of a Thames estuary island. For decades, governments have failed to back any new runway plan in the southeast. They must back one now at Heathrow. That decision would help Hampshire businesses and holidaymakers because Heathrow is nearer than Gatwick. So, I hope that our MPs put pressure on Downing Street.
And now, from Belgarum, an alternative look at the news. Christmas has come early for one Winchester bar, very early indeed. Pitcher and Piano, on the Broadway, was spotted advertising festive bookings last week, a mere 171 days before Santa arrives. Belgarum asked manager Matthew Wright to explain their thinking. "It's not normally this early, but from our head office they're trying to get us to push it a lot earlier this year," he said. "We've had one call from the City Council. They come with us pretty much every year." Will it set a precedent? And there's a picture of an A-board outside the Picture and Piano with a reindeer's head on it in a woolly hat and scarf and the word Christmas in big letters above it. Now the second item. The next time any readers are on St Catherine's Hill, look south past the M3, and on a clear day, you will see the gas holders in Southampton. They are about 12 miles away, but clearly visible on a bright day if they are full. Perhaps not for much longer. Modern ways of handling gas means that these Victorian structures are becoming redundant. Many have been dismantled across the country. It means that there will be a little hole in one of the loveliest poems ever written about Winchester, A Child on St. Catherine's Hill by Jeremy Hooker. He wrote it when he was on a creative writing fellowship at Winchester School of Art between 1981 and 83. The poem is in his collection Master of the Leaping Figures, published in 1987 by Ennitharman Press, then based in Petersfield. It is a beautiful poem about a little girl on the hillside running around in the joy of being alive and scooping in her arms the cathedral, the Hampshire Hog weather vane on the castle, the college boats on the Itchen navigation, the South Downs, the coast, and the blue gasometers of Northam. And finally, he is often known for his quick and witty retorts, seen regularly on TV series such as Mock the Week. But Winchester will get the chance to see the more quizzical side of comedian Hugh Dennis when he hosts a fundraising quiz night. On Thursday, September the 17th, Littleton Millennium Hall will host the £25 a ticket event for The Haven in Wessex, a breast cancer centre in Titchfield.
Thank you. Now we move on to What's On, and there's a couple of items. There's a lunchtime concert in Winchester Cathedral on Tuesday the 21st of July at 1 p.m, and that concert is by Michael Durrant on guitar. It's free with a retiring collection. And on the theatre, the Mayflower Southampton has Shrek the Musical running until July the 26th, various times, and that's followed from the 28th of July to the 1st of August by Annie, and again various times, matinees and evening. The box office for the Mayflower Southampton is 02380 711 811. That's 02380 711 811. Lighting up time ends to Friday the 17th of July at 5:10 a.m. and begins at 9:12 p.m. On Wednesday the 22nd of July, it ends at 5:16 a.m. and begins at 9:06 p.m. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. That's Irene on 01962 870 370. And now we continue with further items of general news. Nikki.
This one, Festival Boost. Organisers of a new music festival in a village near Winchester are celebrating after getting the all-clear from civic chiefs. Members of Winchester's licensing subcommittee unanimously agreed to conditions for the new Greys Festival held at Twyford at a meeting last week. Despite concerns raised by the Hampshire Constabulary over bag searches and some technical details of the event management plan, city councillors authorised the licence, which will allow up to 4,999 people on site at the event on August the 30th. It will be open from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. with headline acts The Blockheads and Paul Young, as well as some bands which played at Glastonbury this year signed up. Co-organisers are locals Roger Walker and Timothy Smith, who hope the new festival will help put Twyford on the map with the acts made famous during the 1980s, as well as entertainers seen at the Hapfair Street Theatre event held in Winchester earlier this month. Mr. Walker, who runs Roger Walker Travel based on the High Street, said, "Obviously we're pleased the council have granted us a licence. It's the first year for us, so we're finding our feet, going through the technicalities. It obviously went to the committee because there were some questions from the police authority, but the committee are happy to accept the way we want to run the festival. The event, originally hoped to be called Twyfest, will be held at Humphreys Farm in Hazley Road, and tickets will cost £50 for a family, two adults and three children, and there will be concessionary prices. All proceeds from the event will go towards local charities. Twyford hopes to join other villages which have put on successful annual music events, including at Wickham and Alsford."
Now here's news of a local crime wave, but caused by animals and not people. Heading, looking out for rheas on the run. Four potentially dangerous large birds were on the loose this week after escaping from a small holding in South Wanston. Police urged residents to be vigilant after reports that a group of ostrich-like rheas had broken into the countryside. The flightless grey-brown birds can reach speeds of up to 40 miles an hour, grow close to 5 feet tall, and have been known to attack humans. Unconfirmed reports on social media suggest that the birds have been seen as far as Upsonbourne, more than 7 miles from their enclosure in Arlesford Drove. Hampshire Constabulary issued an alert on Friday advising villagers to be on the lookout. The Chronicle understands two other rheas escaped last week, but were captured by the plot's owner, Robert Memory. Neighbours on Arlesford Drove said they saw three birds running north through fields over the weekend. Appealing for help on Facebook, Mr. Memory's daughter Terry said, "We've managed to catch some, but are still missing some. They're friendly and can be approached, especially if they're bribed with bread. You can gently lead them back." Putting something over the head really helps. I'm sorry, but if you don't feel confident enough, then don't worry. The breakout comes as Mr. Memory, who keeps a range of animals, including turkeys, pigs and geese, faces a planning battle over his plot. Residents have fiercely opposed his bid to erect barns, sheds, a workshop and animal enclosures, and parts of the site have already been built on. Winchester City Council has received 19 objections and no letters of support, with locals fearing noise, traffic congestion and the chaos of animals spilling onto the road. Neighbour Catherine Hawkins told the Chronicle that she was, quote, locked into her home by animals crossing into her garden. She says, "I had goats in the back garden eating everything. I had ducks, geese, chickens and some pigs have been wandering around recently as well. There's a lot of local concern about it." Mr. Memory was working on site when visited by the Chronicle on Tuesday, and he said, "I'm sick of the people around here. Anything you say gets twisted." He added that he knows how the rheas escaped, but refused further comment. The birds feed on leaves, roots, seeds and fruits. Large males can weigh up to 40 kilograms, and greater rhea use their wings when running to balance when changing direction. The planning application is due to be determined by Tuesday, August the 4th, and it comes months after a common rhea, nicknamed Ron, was photographed near RAF Odium.
And this next item is about countryside crime, but by human beings this time. Think crime and you picture a gritty urban setting, perhaps a darkened street or alleyway, and a gang of threatening-looking hoodies. But some crime, and even the scourge of gangs, can be just as rife in the seemingly tranquil, green and pleasant countryside. 85% of Hampshire is rural, and the latest figures reveal crime is hitting some of the county's countryside communities harder than other parts of the UK. Statistics from rural insurance firm NFU Mutual show a surge in the cost of crime. Largely, this is because of criminals from outside the county who are believed to export stolen machinery abroad. Its latest figures show claims of £970,000 in 2013, which shot up to £1.7 million last year, a 75% increase. And all this comes as Hampshire Constabulary makes its worst ever cuts. The force has already made savings of £55 million in recent years and is looking to slash a further £25 million over the next 2 years. It will lose 1,000 officers by 2017, inevitably making numbers even thinner on the ground in remote areas. Tim Price, Rural Affairs Specialist at NFU Mutual, said, "Despite rural crime levels falling nationally, in Hampshire the figures have, unfortunately, gone up. The rise seems to be driven primarily by farm theft, and we will be issuing our full Rural Crime Survey 2015 in August, which will hopefully give some further insight into this trend." One farmer, David Powell from Lockerley in the Test Valley, had his machinery stolen three times in as many years, totalling well over £10,000 in 10 years. Test Valley Farm Watch coordinator Ruth Harper Adams said there has been an increase in thefts from agricultural premises. She said, "We can safely say in the last 6 to 12 months there has been an increase. Sometimes I think there's more crime in the countryside than in the town. This has been in two different areas. One is expensive machinery, like quad bikes up to tractors. We have also seen an increase in thefts of smaller scale items, equipment from anything from hand tools to power tools. There are probably more opportunity thefts of things like livestock troughs, electric fences or shearing tools. While thieves can be opportunistic, striking at any time, Mrs. Harper Adams said gangs were hitting farms late at night and often choosing harsh weather to mask any sounds. She said, "There has definitely been an increase in organised crime. They will target a couple of evenings and nights and steal expensive equipment. It is thought stolen tractors and machinery are exported out of ports such as Portsmouth and Southampton and destined for Eastern Europe. To thwart thieves, vehicles and machinery from a dozen farms across the Test Valley are being marked with the SESAR data tag system that covers farm machines with thousands of micro dots. Police and customs officers have scanners which can detect the dots, which tells them who the vehicle belongs to. But it's not just farmers falling victim to villains. Cars parked in beauty spots are being targeted too. This is especially so in the New Forest, where crime has shot up. Here there have been 503 reported rural crimes since 2012. Overall, there have been 500 thefts from vehicles in the county's countryside in the past 3 years. This kind of crime has prompted the police to launch a blitz on rural crime called Operation Falcon.
Collision that killed rider was inevitable. A coroner has called for tougher sanctions at motocross events after a teenager died in Winchester. An inquest heard how Bradley Hooper, a 16-year-old from Farnham, was killed when he came off his bike at the Tony Moto track near Headbornworthy and was hit by another rider on May the 11th last year. He was later pronounced dead after being airlifted to Southampton General Hospital. Recording a verdict of accidental death, Senior Coroner for Central Hampshire, Graham Short, recommended a review of the Motocross Federation's, MCF, code of conduct regarding the briefing given to safety marshals prior to any events. He also said that the current marshalling rules of Portsmouth Motocross Club, which hired and ran the track when Bradley was hit, needed to be assessed. His warnings came after evidence emerged that marshals were able to have their mobile phones with them during practice and race sessions. The hearing was told that collision was inevitable when Bradley, a motocross enthusiast since the age of six, died soon after he was landed on by another rider who had been given no warning Bradley had come off his bike. The other rider, also 16, said riding conditions were perfect, but there was nothing he could do when he saw Bradley half stood in the centre of the track as he was on his way down from a jump, having gone at it maximum throttle. He was driving a Yamaha 250 when he landed on Bradley's chest, right where he was expecting to land, he told the hearing. The first thing I tried to do was to try to pull myself and the bike out of the way, he said. Once you're airborne, there's not much you can do. I tried as best as I could. He told the hearing he sustained two compression fractures to his spine and was knocked unconscious as a result of the impact. Chief Marshal Anita Sanders broke down briefly when she described performing CPR on Bradley. She said, I knew something was really wrong. The paramedics' words to me were, he's arrested, so I started chest compressions until I was told to stop. The medics were doing everything they possibly could to try and keep him alive. Described as a competent and cautious rider, Bradley had turned out with his family for the Sunday track day when he was critically injured during the practice session. The consultant histopathologist, Dr. Vipul Fauria, told the hearing Bradley died from a severe tear in his right lung. He also tore other organs and sustained several fractured ribs. Mr. Short said, The death of any 16-year-old is highly emotional, and I know it's very difficult for his family in these circumstances. It's caused great distress.
Launch of campaign to conserve Bible. Winchester residents are being given the chance to own a piece of history as part of a fundraising campaign. The Cathedral Trust has launched an appeal to sponsor the conservation of the Winchester Bible, which is due to go on show at a specialist exhibition. Believed to be about 850 years old, it will take centre stage in the south transept of the cathedral, but is in need of repair. Many of the parchment leaves are damaged, and some of the illustrations are flaking away. The group is asking people to sponsor a page. Each page sponsorship costs £1,000, or £50 a quarter for 5 years, and each donation of £1,000 will be acknowledged with a life-sized copy of the Bible, including the Genesis initial.
Colin to step down after half a century. After an innings spanning over 50 years loyal and unstinting devotion to the organisation and well-being of recreational cricket in Hampshire, Colin Savage, probably the best known and most experienced administrator in Hampshire cricket, has taken the decision to retire. He has finally relinquished his position with the Hampshire Cricket Board, based at the Aegeus Bowl, but will continue in the role of company secretary. Previously, he played significant roles with the Hampshire League, both as an administrator and chairman of an organisation which is understood to be the biggest recreational competition of its type in the country. A respected senior civil servant in his earlier professional life, alongside his family, sport has been Colin's passion throughout his life. An enthusiastic cricketer, he played for many years for Alverstoke and Flamingo cricket clubs as a spin bowler and lower order batsman. It is rumoured he would like the words, "He was a useful cricketer," etched on his gravestone. He is also a lifelong Saints supporter and St Mary's season ticket holder, as well as being an avid ornithologist. His knowledge on all counts is encyclopaedic. However, he is best known for his enormous contribution to the formation and running of the Hampshire League, which began in 1973. He devoted over 40 years of service to the wider cricket community in Hampshire through his involvement with the Hampshire League, firstly as a member of First Committee in 1973 and ultimately as chairman. Colin played a central role in establishing the link between the Hampshire and Southern Leagues in 1990, which forms the basis of the Hampshire Pyramid for club cricket, which is regarded as a model elsewhere. In presenting him with a framed and autographed Hampshire shirt, HCB chairman John Wolfe said, "Colin's contribution to the Hampshire Cricket League, and more recently to the Hampshire Board since 2000, has been immense. His patience, unfailing courtesy, and willingness to listen to the points of view of others are qualities greatly valued by those who worked with him. They have enabled him to help clubs, the leagues, and the board to overcome numerous potential difficulties over the years, especially those arising at the time of the link-up between the Southern League and Hampshire League to form the Pyramid, which we all now take for granted." Colin has also received a Hampshire Life membership, a well-deserved acknowledgement, and there's a lovely picture of Colin, I think in his garden, smiling, looking very relaxed and happy, holding the framed autographed shirt.
Banned for drink crash. A Winchester drink driver who flipped over her car on a suburban road has been banned from driving for a year. Tulasi Maya Rai, 36, admitted driving with excess alcohol on Milverton Road, full flood, on June the 7th, a court heard. Rai, of Highcroft Road, crashed a 15-reg Vauxhall Corsa when her alcohol level was 56 micrograms per 100 millilitres of breath. The legal limit is 35. Magistrates in Basingstoke fined her £140 and told her to pay a £20 victim surcharge, £85 costs and £150 criminal courts charge. And there's an amazing picture of the car completely tipped over. How she managed to do it, heavens only knows. Police standing around, lights on it, and the underside completely exposed in Milverton Road, full flood.
Now, here's a most surprising headline. £10 million council underspend. Winchester civic chiefs have hailed their effective management of the public purse after underspending by more than £10 million this year. The City Council spent £11.8 million of its 2014-15 capital budget of £18.6 million, Cabinet was told. Most of the £7.4 million saving came from an unspent £4 million to buy and build property. Some cash was saved on the refurbishment of Avalon House, which reopened last month with new tenants Southern Health NHS Foundation Trust. The council also spent £15.9 million of its general budget covering key council services, £2.7 million less than expected. Councillor Stephen Godfrey, the council's leader and finance chief, said, "Although we've not spent all the money we planned to, what we have spent, and it's been a busy year, has been managed and controlled effectively." He added, "This is despite the very many problems we've been facing with our finances in terms of the variations and challenges in projects, the legal challenges and the like." Cabinet agreed to carry most of the money forward for spending in the next year in the 2015-16 budget.
Fracking wells are heading south, Minister tells MPs. Opponents of fracking, earmarked for parts of Hampshire, including around Winchester, need to understand better the huge benefits, a government minister has said. Andrea Leedsom, who is the Minister for Change for Energy and Climate Change, vowed to use an element of persuasion to convince local people to accept drilling for shale gas after a pioneering application was thrown out in Lancashire. But, intervening in a Commons debate, Southampton Test MP Alan Whitehead warned that thousands of fracking wells were heading to the south, including Hampshire. The Labour backbencher said up to 18,000 wells would be needed to replace 10% of conventional gas and cut the need for supplies from Qatar or Russia. He said, "Wells would be concentrated in the two areas of the UK where there are reasonable shale plays. Those shale plays are geologically faulted and difficult to get at. Boland Shale in the northeast of England and across the Weald in the south." Mr. Whitehead added, "The proposition in front of us is not for occasional bits of exploration. It is go for it. Let's have a substantial fracking industry. The process of trucks, wastewater and refracking would have to be repeated every few years on that well pad in order to keep it going." The comments came ahead of likely new guidelines that will, controversially, allow shale gas to be extracted from under national parks, including the South Downs and the New Forest. Ministers have suggested they will allow horizontal drilling under protected beauty spots from wells put up just outside them, potentially for up to 3 kilometres. At least 8 licences for possible fracking have already been issued to gas companies in South Hampshire, including around Southampton and Winchester. Responding to the debate, Ms. Leedsom argued there were enormous potential benefits from shale gas for energy security, jobs, growth and community investment. Fracking could make Britain less reliant on imports from abroad, whilst providing more jobs and creating a new domestic industry. Ministers hope the first wells will be dug this year, confident that opposition to fracking will fall away when they are up and running. But there is fierce criticism about the carrying of contaminated water underground and self-monitoring by fracking companies of any earthquakes triggered.
Mum is inspired to join the clergy after crash. A Hampshire churchgoer inspired to join the clergy after surviving a dramatic car crash in France has been ordained. Amy Webb's car was totally destroyed as it rolled over twice, containing her and her daughters Isabel and Matilda. then aged 7 and 5 years. No one was hurt in the crash in 2009. The 40-year-old saw their miraculous survival as proof that God was calling her to join the Church of England clergy. She became a reverend at a ceremony at Portsmouth Cathedral and is now set to become curate in Botley, Curdridge and Durley, near Bishop's Waltham. Ms. Webb, who worships at St. John's Church in Fareham, said, "When the car came to rest in this field, I had this amazing sense of God's presence in the silence. It was a desperate situation. I bought the car with my divorce money. The insurance didn't cover it, and I lost the ferry ticket in the crash. But I was alive, and so were the girls, and I felt that God was saying to me that my life could end at any time, and what was I going to do with it?" Ordination as deacon, the first of 6 stages, means Miss Webb can wear a dog collar, preach and lead services, including weddings. She will serve Botley's All Saints, Durley's Holy Cross and St Peter's Church in Curdridge. Ms Webb added, "I had joined the choir at St Columba Church in Fareham when I was 11, but then drifted away from church when I was about 16. I was married at 22 and had my girls when I was 26 and 28, but my marriage was falling apart. 5 weeks after my second daughter was born, my husband left me. We'd made a bit of mess of our lives. By that time, I'd become involved with St John's Church through an Alpha course. I saw a leaflet come through the door, went along and found them very welcoming. I became more involved with the church, and over the last 15 years, they've helped me through the end of my marriage, my divorce and bringing up my 2 girls. And there's a couple of photographs, one of Amy Webb, quite understandably smiling and looking happy with her life, and a picture of the car, which is seriously smashed. The roof is crunched down, the windscreen smashed, the front is covered in mud, and the mirrors are hanging off. Lucky to have survived.
Villagers' lost sons honoured. The last post rang across the Candover Valley as the peaceful parish of Northington unveiled a memorial to its war dead. A plaque honouring 11 local men who fell in the World Wars was revealed at a poignant ceremony attended by relatives and dignitaries on Tuesday. Guests fell silent 100 years to the day since the first soldier from the parish, near Alresford, died in battle. Rifleman Charles Aubrey fell on July the 14th, 1915. Families of 4 other soldiers from the villages of Northington, Swarriton and Topford were among 40 present at St John the Evangelist Church. A plaque was erected at the foot of a monument to the second Lord Ashburton, built by his widow in 1865 and now rededicated as a war memorial. A descendant of his was amongst those honoured, Lieutenant Colonel Guy Baring, the sitting Winchester MP who rejoined the Coldstream Guards on the outbreak of war, despite being over the age limit and in a protected profession. The current Lord Ashburton opened the ceremony on the church mound ahead of veneration from the Reverend David Chittell and an address from the Lord Lieutenant of Hampshire, Nigel Atkinson. Buglers from the Rifles sounded the last post and reveille to mark the beginning and end of the period of silence. The memorial was also the 99th anniversary of Lance Sergeant Herbert Andrews of Totford Farm receiving his military medal. His great-nephew, Godfrey Andrews, still lives nearby in Alresford. Following the ceremony, Mr. Andrews told the Chronicle, "It was lovely. It's wonderful that 100 years later people are still remembering. I don't think that they would have ever thought that in 100 years people would remember the sacrifices they made." Tuesday's picturesque setting was until recently waste ground. Many villagers already thought the Lord Ashburton monument was a war memorial, according to an informal poll by the day's organisers. But until this week, the only true recognition was a small brass plaque inside the church. And this plaque also remembered Private William White, the only Northington parishioner known to have fallen in the Great War.
Primary school on the up after difficult years. A Winchester primary school appears to be improving after criticism from Ofsted inspectors. Winchester MP Steve Brine visited Oliver's Battery Primary School and declared the school on the up after a number of difficult years. He visited the school to meet new head teacher Faye Wood to discuss the turnaround plan now in place. Mr. Brine heard how the school has been working hard to get to a good Ofsted rating after a difficult few years, which have seen it placed in requires improvement since October 2013. A report from Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Schools said that senior leaders and governors are taking effective action to tackle the areas requiring improvement. Oliver's Battery faces a second Ofsted inspection in October. Mr. Brine said, "Things have not been great at Oliver's Battery for quite a while now, and it's not acceptable to staff, parents, or us in government. These kids deserve the best start in life, and for their school to match some of the high-achieving institutions elsewhere in Winchester. It was very good to meet Faye Wood, who certainly comes from some tough challenges elsewhere. If anyone can turn this school around, it's her, and the team, new and old, that are in the school." Miss Wood said, "The school has come a long way since October 2013 and is definitely on the up." Mr. Brine spent time answering questions from students in years 1 to 6.
Donations helped by bicycle. A Kingsworthy girl who had her bike stolen and smashed got something better in return as the community came together to buy a new one. Ella Shepherd, age 9, was devastated to learn thieves had taken her bike from her home last month. But now she's riding an upgraded replacement after her family appealed for help on social media. Dog walker Kirsty Howell found the damaged pink bike in local woods and posted a photo to Face Bay, Winchester, an online marketplace. Rosie Lee, Ella's godmother, posted to the group asking if anyone would pledge towards a replacement bike. Residents and organisations, including Peace Jam, Winchester, and Winchester People of Action, raised £70 in less than 2 hours. Miss Lee contacted Halfords, who agreed to upgrade Ella to a bigger bike with a lock and a helmet thrown in for her upcoming birthday. Ella's mother, Rosie Marshall, said, "Everyone's been fantastic and Halfords deserve the positive press too, as they didn't have to help either." Ella said, "It was really cool and amazing. Thank you to everyone for helping me." And there's the sweetest picture of Ella, blonde, with her new bike outside Halfords.
Boxes put up in Downs for at-risk barn owl species. They are one of the iconic sights of the countryside, a barn owl on the hunt in the gathering dusk. But in recent years, the numbers have been declining. Now, more than 220 barn owl boxes have been installed across the South Downs by the National Park Authority and the South Downs Volunteer Ranger Service. These boxes are now being surveyed, and any chicks found are then tagged as part of a national scheme to protect the birds. A special licence is required to do this, and their locations are being kept secret to prevent any disturbance. The owls declined over the 20th century, and although numbers have stabilised since the mid-1990s, the British Trust for Ornithology estimates that now only about 4,000 breeding pairs remain. Angela Ward, who's a park ranger, said, "The owls struggle to find homes because they like to nest in holes in large old trees and barns, and there are less of these around than there used to be. Our volunteers have been busy making barn owl boxes, and we're putting them up in situations all over the national park."
New headmaster at college. Winchester College will have a new headmaster from September 2016. Dr. Timothy Hands, currently Master of Magdalen College School, Oxford, has been appointed to replace Dr. Ralph Townsend, who is retiring. The Warden and Fellows approached Dr. Hands due to his successful record at two leading independent schools. Since 2008, he has taken Magdalen College School from strength to strength, not only driving up academic standards, but also stressing the importance of pastoral care. Dr. Hans has extended relationships with the city, including initiating a highly regarded arts festival, and has recently been chairman of the Headmasters' Conference. He publishes on 19th and 20th century literature and is a devotee of music and sport. Dr. Hans was educated in the state sector, studying the violin at the Guildhall and reading English at King's College, London.
Important gap in city history finally filled. A story in the telling of Winchester history has been told at last. A new trail and leaflet have been launched to tell the story of the Jews in medieval Winchester. It marks the success of a campaign launched by local businessman Danny Hable, who felt their history had been ignored. The new initiative was launched by the City Council and the University at the Guildhall, an event attended by around 70 people. The leaflet was launched by the Deputy Lord Lieutenant, Lady Appleyard. The Jewish community was hugely important in the Middle Ages, hence Jewry Street. A team of researchers at the university, led by Dr. Christina Welsh, focused on a period in the early Middle Ages when Winchester was a national centre. The Jewish community endured heavy fines, imprisonment and execution before their eventual expulsion in 1290, and some of these stories are retold in the new publication. The trail uncovers the sites of various past landmarks, including a synagogue, a statue of a blindfolded young woman named Synagogia, and a grand stone house owned by David of Oxford. As few of these landmarks remain today, the council commissioned a local artist to provide illustrations, an initiative funded by Mr. Hable, in memory of his parents, Jack and Greta, refugees from the Holocaust, who set up home here. Mr. Hable said, "The medieval Jewish Winchester Trail has been developed because our community wanted to tell a story, not always a comfortable one, of a community that endured persecution, fines and imprisonment, and which is an integral part of the city's rich cultural past. Although overall a wealthy community, the majority of the population were poor, and life for many was extremely hard, and their persecution and expulsion should not be forgotten." Mr. Hable added, "I found the launch very moving. There was such a warm, inclusive atmosphere amongst all those present, which included councillors and officers, members of the Jewish community, many Christian well-wishers, and several city tourist guides. To think that this history has been brushed under the carpet for centuries, it shows the life the Jewish community had to endure, but with the dedication to my parents, demonstrates how Winchester is now more tolerant towards minorities." And there's a photograph of everyone who was involved, including Danny Hable, at the back.
Now here's a piece about a recent visitor to the city who's a national figure in his field. And it's headed, "Expert Calls for Care Over Advancement." "The development of modern medical science needs to be controlled very carefully," Professor Robert Winston has warned. A guest speaker at the Winchester Festival, he emphasised the importance of people being well informed about medical advances, which could be developed for their financial potential and not necessarily for their usefulness to human beings. He gave the example of the freezing of eggs and keeping them for many years so that the woman involved could pursue a career and later on, when she had the time, could use the eggs. But posters that he'd observed on the tube urging people to freeze eggs is, to quote him, "advertising that ought to be illegal." The professor continued, "The success rate at its highest is 2.9%, and last year it was under 2%. This process is led by a massive market and a drive for profit. And there was also the possibility of damage to be considered. He was, he said, concerned about the cost of these medical procedures, and one reason that he left the development of in vitro fertilisation early on was that it was so very expensive and the chances of positive outcomes were so small. Improvement of scientific literacy was vitally emphasised, and in spite of the sometimes difficult scientific and medical language he used, the full Guildhall audience followed him closely, and afterwards many said how marvellous the talk had been. Lord Winston is Professor of Science and Society and Emeritus Professor of Fertility Studies at Imperial College London. He's Britain's best-known reproductive health expert. And that's accompanied by a picture of Lord Winston, looking as he always does, with his thick moustache and even thicker glasses.
The hospital cigar Churchill smoked. He was remembered for his oversized coat, booming voice, bowler hat, and the fat cigar firmly clasped between his thumb and forefinger. Winston Churchill was often seen chuffing away on a fat cigar, even when he lay in his hospital bed. Now, the chewed end of that cigar is due to go under the hammer at auction. The item, over 50 years old, is expected to reach somewhere in the region of £1,000. The great Second World War leader, who was known for enjoying a tipple or two, was recuperating in hospital from a fractured hip after he tumbled out of bed in 1962. Before the days of health and safety, Churchill was permitted to puff away happily in the ward, stubbing it out in an ashtray. It was collected by a student nurse to give to her little brother, saved in paper bag with the words Middlesex Hospital Soiled Dressing Disposable Bag, where it has been ever since. It is now going on sale, offered by Dukes of Dorchester on October the 15th. Smoking cigars is like falling in love, Churchill is known to have said. First, you are attracted by its shape. You stay for its flavour, and you must always remember never, never to let the flame go out. Churchill was aged 87 when he was admitted to hospital that year, where he spent several weeks in the Wolavington Wing for private patients. During his stay, he contracted bronchitis and pneumonia, which led to thrombosis, and it was believed he would not survive the ordeal because of his age. Timothy Medhurst, auctioneer at Duke's, said, "This cigar marks a pivotal moment for Sir Winston Churchill. Churchill had already experienced many injuries, and to have such a devastating injury occur at such an old age was a threat to his stalwart British bulldog image. Though Churchill largely relied on his walking stick by the time this broken hip occurred, the operation to fix the fracture would have caused a shortening in his leg. And photographs following 1962 always show Churchill leaning on his iconic walking stick. This injury in 1962 was also a poignant moment in Churchill's personal life. His beloved poodle, Rufus II, died while he was in hospital recovering. It is not surprising that Churchill's cigar smoking in his hospital bed was widely recorded. This year marks the 50-year anniversary of Churchill's death. The cigar is something we all associate with Churchill, one of the great leaders. We expect there to be a great interest in it, and it could sell for thousands. And there's a picture of him holding up this very bedraggled-looking cigar end. I wonder if he's right.
Genealogist passes away. Well-known Hampshire genealogist and retired local government officer Leonard Ruffell has died aged 75. In a career with Hampshire County Council spanning 20 years, he was respected for his straightforward and firm style of management and sense of humour. His time at the castle was the happiest period of his working life. He was a loyal leader and a determined adversary of any threat to his team's performance and development. He retired in 2001. Len's other passion was genealogy. He began tracing his family tree in 1971 and was able to trace the Ruffells, an old Hampshire family, back 300 years through 10 generations. He joined the Hampshire Genealogical Society and edited its journal, The Hampshire Family Historian, from 1984 to 1995. As chairman of the Society from 2004, he championed family history, giving countless talks and holding exhibitions of his work. He was in demand as a speaker, combining skill as a raconteur with his own brand of humour. Len of Abbots Anne Road, Hairstock, was born in Rownhams, and moved to Bournemouth at the age of three, beginning his working life aged 15 at Bournemouth Borough Council. He married Anne Mary Dean in 1964, and a year later they emigrated to Sydney, Australia. For 3 years they lived in Bondi, and Len was employed by Waverley Council as chief cashier. In those days, the men were paid in cash, and when doing the rounds with their weekly pay, he was required to carry a gun. Fortunately, he never had to use it. In 1968, they returned to England and their posts in local government. As a daily chronicler of life, he kept a diary from the age of 17 until the day before his death, when he recorded his last entry. In 2004, he wrote a regular series of articles on family history for the Chronicle and Daily Echo. Len and Anne celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary last year. He loved people and had the knack of being able to talk to anyone on any subject. He managed to highlight the absurd to maximum benefit and cause gales of laughter. An expansive and big personality. As a friend commented, if he was in the room, you were always aware he was there. Len died on July the 3rd after being diagnosed with prostate cancer 2 years ago, and there's a lovely picture of Len showing a face that definitely is the one that would make the room laugh and be happy.
Young media stars shine. Pupils from a special needs school in Winchester have just returned from London with the main prize at this year's National Shine School Media Awards. In April, more than 30 pupils at Osborne School took part in launching a new magazine called Hashtag Osborne. They edited and designed the publication themselves. The Harrison Cup was awarded to the creative team at the Glamorous Awards, alongside two highly commended awards and a cheque for £1,000. The Shine Award judges, which included newspaper columnist Simon Heffer, said, "We were particularly impressed with the creativity as well as the humour demonstrated by the pupils and also the support provided by the teachers at Osborne School." The awards promote excellence in media and design, and any school can enter. Pupils from Osborne intend to encourage more special needs schools to take part. Thomas Williams, nominated in the Outstanding Pupil category, said, "We want every school to have a magazine like ours. We're working on issue 2 now and it's looking pretty cool." And there's a lovely photograph at the top of there with five very proud-looking young people, flanked by national columnist Simon Heffer on one side and the chief judge on the other. They all look very proud and they deserve to be.
Butterfly event marks reserve's anniversary. A Hampshire Wildlife Reserve, which once formed part of a First World War army camp, is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Butterfly Conservation's Magdalen Hill Down Reserve, near Winchester, is nationally recognised for the many species it supports, with more than 10,000 seen every year. Members of the public are being invited to celebrate the milestone by attending a Big Butterfly Count Family Day, between 10:30 to 2:30 on Sunday, this coming Sunday, I assume. Clive Wood, Vice Chairman for Butterfly Conservation's Hampshire and Isle of Wight branch, said, "This really is a big milestone for the reserve and celebrates all the hard work put in over the years by the many volunteers and staff. We would love for people living in and around the area to show their support for this beautiful place and all the wildlife it supports." There will be free guided walks, face painting, badge making, and many other activities. A painting competition is also being run for children, where they're asked to create artwork that celebrates the butterflies and moths of the reserve, with some great prizes on offer for the winners. The reserve has an abundance of small blue and chalkhill blue butterflies. Last year, the site recorded the second highest count of small blues in the UK, and more than 1,000 chalkhill blue butterflies have been counted on a single one-hour walk. Since 1990, it has been extended from 23 acres to 120 acres, and there is a picture of the site as it was in the First World War when it was an army camp, with the tents and the men sitting outside relaxing.
Guides are well up to challenge. Girls tackle a variety of exercises. Alsford Girl Guides were put to the test with their teamwork skills and creativity as part of Hampshire's first Midsummer Challenge. Five girls from the first Alsford Guides were given an opportunity to sleep in the wilderness. as they tackled making fires, cooking from scratch, and a whole host of team exercises. They were mentored by the youth activity team from RAF Odium, who taught them first-hand tricks about surviving in the great outdoors. Faced with no less than 20 challenges over a weekend, the guides climbed through huge spider webs, built towers to time, and eventually mastered how to light fires using the barest of natural materials and equipment. Sergeant Alex Rylance of the RAF Odium team said, Using a positive outlook interests the girls in outdoor life, and part of our work is to get the girls in touch with STAM activities, science, technology, engineering and maths. County Commissioner Angela Hammond said, "It's fantastic to see so many girls from across the county taking part in a whole range of activities." And there's a photograph of all the girls sheltering under a very makeshift bit of tarpaulin, which I would not want to be there if it was really wet. But good luck to them.
And that concludes the extracts for this week. So thank you to our editors, Margaret Boyden and Linda Vincent, and to our copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And, of course, thanks to our readers, Nikki Baring.
Goodbye.
John Regan.
Goodbye.
And Daphne Poupart.
Goodbye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye and do have an enjoyable week. When you've finished with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.